The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to Shop Talk. This is Mike Consul, and our topic is medical office real estate. Our guest is Mike Hargrave, who is principal at Revista, which provides healthcare property data and industry information to investors in the medical real estate space. Mr. Hargrave's career covers senior housing, healthcare, and real estate finance. Prior to joining Revista, he was vice president and chief market and data strategist for the National Investment Center for the Seniors Housing and Care Industry, also known as NIC. While at NIC, he oversaw the development and growth of the organization's data and analysis service, which grew to become one of the senior housing industry's chief sources of data, covering almost 13,000 properties in 100 metro markets. Mike Hargrave, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me on and excited to spread the word about healthcare real estate.
Well, we're excited to have you, Mike. I will say, though, that one of the reasons we're on this topic is we're all getting old here, and the baby boom generation is moving into their high-intensity healthcare usage years. But much to the delight of many real estate investors, medical office is looking like a really strong sector this round. Let me ask you about the scale of the medical office sector. How large is it?
It's a broad and large sector. Basically, when we talk about typical medical office buildings, we're talking about buildings that are generally purpose-built for healthcare-related services. The predominant tenants in these buildings are healthcare practices. A lot of times, outpatient procedures can be performed in these buildings. When we look at that sector, just the outpatient sector, you're talking about there's around 34,000 of these properties located throughout the United States, representing about 1.4 billion square feet. And we ascribe a market value of roughly about $360 billion to that sector. We also add to that the hospital sort of inpatient sector. So you have outpatient and inpatient. When you look at that sector, you're talking, you know, about 5,400 hospitals throughout the United States, and that has a market value of a little over $600 billion. It's a little more valuable on a per square foot basis. So all told, you're talking about a healthcare real estate sector that's just about $1 trillion in real estate value. So it's a very large sector and very interesting to track.
One of the things I'm curious about is how readily can real estate be repurposed for medical office? And let me explain why I'm asking. I know that there's a lot of malls out there that are kind of the class B and C malls that a lot of real estate experts say they're not going to survive. They're going to have to be repurposed. And I know they've been repurposed in some cases for educational facilities, say a college or a university satellite or whatnot. When it comes to whether it's a mall or other an office building or whatever, is medical real estate something that can be repurposed, or is it so specific that it needs to be new construction?
Absolutely. In fact, there's been, you know, a real trend in place over the past, you know, really 5 to 10 years amongst hospitals and healthcare systems to really locate their services out in the community. And this concept of ease of access is a big component of where healthcare systems want to locate. So you'll notice, depending upon where you'll live, they'll be located in retail strip centers with their urgent care products, or they'll be located, you know, on the corner, you know, if it's not Main and Main, it's Main and Second. And that includes repurposing retail. So a good example of that is recently in suburban Philadelphia, there was an old clothing store chain, Sims Warehouse, which I believe went out of business in several locations, and a developer purchased one of their, you know, single-story retail locations. I think it was 100 and some odd thousand square feet. You know, they paid whatever for that, but then they went to the University of Pennsylvania's health system and negotiated with them to locate their services in this building. And so they took over the entire building. You know, they spent quite a bit of money on build out Penn as well as this developer. And that building was just purchased in January by LaSalle Investment Trust, which is one of the original sort of institutional grade medical office investors in the space. And it's, you know, that that building is a great retail location. You know, Penn and this developer spent significant money in redeveloping it. It's really a, you know, it's really on one of the great sites in I believe it's in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and it's subject to a, you know, long-term lease that really is of great value to not only the health system but also to LaSalle Investment Management. So there's many examples of that happening throughout the United States. That's probably one of the most recently prominent ones, but I would say that there's a significant amount of retail real estate that's being repurposed for healthcare purposes.
So whether we're talking about new design and construction or the repurposing, as we were just talking about, how fast is the medical office sector growing today, and how does that compare with past periods of its growth?
Well, overall, the sector is scheduled to deliver roughly about 22 million square feet of new space this year. That's up from about 17 million square feet that was delivered in 2016. So construction has been rising recently. That equates to inventory growth of roughly about 1.8-1.9% on an annual basis. But if you relate that to previous periods, during the period leading up to the recession, the sector had deliveries of well over 25 million square feet annually. So we haven't quite gotten back to the periods that we were seeing inventory growth-wise prior to the recession. In addition to that, you know, the growth is really, it's 1.7, 1.8, 1.9% on an annual basis, which when you take into consideration some of the demand measures on the tenant side and demand measures on the population growth side, it's really growth that's been warranted, and it's largely being driven by the hospitals and health systems that, again, are trying to actively get their services and healthcare products out into the outpatient setting and oftentimes into the community.
You know, I know that there are these doctors groups that they'll band together and they'll open an MRI clinic, and it leads me to my next question, which is, who are the major owners and investors in medical office buildings? Are they, you mentioned LaSalle, obviously an institutional player, but if you look at the industry as a whole, who are the major owners of it and investors?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The industry, as you can imagine, is largely owned by the users of these buildings. So hospitals and health systems and physician offices, they own roughly about 55% of the entire medical office sector. The hospitals make up the largest component of ownership. It's important to remember, as a user group, the hospitals and health systems are largely credit rated, and compared to institutional investors, they have ready access to the bond markets, and their cost of capital oftentimes is lower than those investors that are chasing their assets. And so they make the argument, right or wrong, they make the argument that it's more efficient, it's cheaper for us to really own the real estate. We want to own it. And so hospitals, even to this day, prefer to own real estate. Having said that, you know, as hospitals have moved increasingly off campus and are establishing locations out in the community, just like this LaSalle Investment Management example that we just brought up, they're open to the idea of either institutional investors or different investors or REITs owning their assets. And so these groups are seeing small, measurable increases in terms of their ownership profiles, but as a whole, like, private investors own roughly about 15% of the outpatient stock, and then REITs own about 10% of the stock. There's actually dedicated healthcare REITs that are not only diversified and own medical office as well as, you know, senior housing or lab space assets, but there are actually a few dedicated medical office REITs that are out there that own these assets. And so, in all, I would say it's about a quarter, institutionally owned by either REITs or private investors, and then the remainder is largely user-owned and user-developed.
Let's talk about financing, which you've already referenced, and during the introduction I had mentioned that you have a background in real estate finance. So more broadly speaking, what type of financing is available to an owner or an investor, somebody who's interested in investing in medical office space?
The sector is largely underwritten by local banks as general office. There are some banks that have dedicated healthcare real estate groups. Most banks will tell you they like medical office because they like the fact that the tenancy, the physician tenants, tend to stay longer. They view them as very creditworthy tenants, especially if a health system or the local hospital is taking on space in a building. And so there's plenty of, in many cases, to fund construction, there's plenty of local bank financing for these projects. The REITs themselves have a very insatiable appetite for these assets, and so they're actively chasing assets that are owned by health systems and hospitals and larger physician groups. They're willing to pay low yields for these assets relative to other assets that are out there. Again, because they view the tenants as very credit worthy in many cases, especially when they're credit rated. There's a very large appetite for these types of assets. So REIT financing is readily available for many of the assets out there. In addition to that, there's CMBS and other forms of financing that are available. I wouldn't think that there's a significant amount of private equity that really targets the sector right now. Yes, you have LaSalle, you have Heitman targets the sector, and you have a few other bigger name. Bentall Kennedy, I believe, has some ownership in the sector, but all in all, compared to other real estate sectors, you don't see private equity being as much, like institutional grade private equity being as much of a larger player as you might see in other sectors. The other private equity owners, there's a lot of smaller private equity shops that have set up kind of specialty sort of healthcare real estate shops, and they might be region or even market specific, and those types of entities own a significant amount of the real estate out there. But generally, large institutional grade private equity, we don't see a ton of that involved in the sector.
So let's talk about demand. I mean, obviously, the nightmare scenario for a lender or an investor is they jump into a sector, and all of a sudden the demand dries up, and they can't fill the space, and loan default starts to happen. This doesn't seem to be that kind of a space right now, Mike. It's obviously very strong. But what about the demand? Where's the demand coming from? Is it strictly that we're getting older and we have higher healthcare needs? And how fast is it growing? So where's the demand coming from, and how quickly is it growing?
Really, when you look at the demand side of the sector, there's a lot of reasons to really like the investment case for the sector. You have not only the fact that the over 65 population are the group that's most likely to have more visits to the physician offices than any other group, demographic group out there. And that group is growing faster than any other demographic group in the United States right now. So from a population standpoint, you have a lot of demographic demand that's driving demand for outpatient space. In addition, I mentioned earlier, but you have the fact that hospitals and health system and physician groups are, I mean, it's there's almost like a race to get out into the community and bring healthcare to the community rather than expecting the community to come to these large, you know, integrated healthcare campuses that are oftentimes difficult to navigate. So you have that's another a driver out there. In addition, you have technology, which is making it easier and more possible to perform procedures nowadays that otherwise might have only been able to be delivered within the hospital setting just a few years ago, being able to be delivered in an outpatient off-campus setting. And so, you know, all of these things are driving demand on the outpatient side. And then you add to that really the stable nature of the sector in that these leases oftentimes are 10 to 15 or even more years in length, that physicians and doctors and health systems and hospitals really want to locate somewhere and they want to stay there. So tenant renewal rates are on average industry-wide around 80%. And as a result, you know, occupancy rates in the sector are largely stable for a long period of time. And so on the demand side, you not only have growth, you not only have, you know, significant tailwinds that are kind of at the back of the sector, but you also have this real stable nature of the sector. One of the things on the growth side, which is interesting, is even though you might not have as much volatility from a fundamental standpoint, from an occupancy standpoint, you also don't see the same volatility on the rent side. So while rents will generally not go down in the sector, they generally grow on average 2 to 3%, and it's because of the nature of these long-term leases that are generally in place in these buildings. So you won't see kind of the swings that you'll see in some of the other real estate sectors. But if you can, if you like stability, if you like that sort of long-term stability equation of a sector, this is a very good sector to look at.
Well, let's talk about the stability a little bit, because right now there's a lot of people looking at the real estate cycle and feeling that we're running pretty close to a correction. That really changes the calculation for a lot of real estate investors, but is medical office real estate different? Does it perform to the same dynamics as the rest of the real estate world, or is medical office, because of the nature of medical care and the population's need, is it somehow immune to some of the real estate cycles?
I wouldn't say it's immune. I mean, again, I referenced earlier, you have back in that 2007-2008 period, just before the Great Recession, you know, you did have over 25 million square feet that was scheduled to be delivered within the sector. And so, you know, as a result, the occupancy rates came down a little bit as that inventory was being delivered, you know, really at the worst time during the recession. I don't recall a lot of defaults or distress in the sector from back then, but if you look at it overall, the occupancy rates heading into that period, and again, this is a legacy data service that I'm referencing here, but you can see that the occupancy rates came down about 150 or so, 175 basis points during that period, which, again, if you compared and contrast that to really any other sector out there, it would be largely looked at as stable and flat, you know, compared to others. So So it, you know, it does react naturally, and there's going to be some projects, depending upon how many deliveries are out there, that don't do as well as probably the pro forma says. But largely, you know, again, I point back to the case that you have these long-term leases in place. You have they're delivering healthcare services in these buildings and in these suites that is much less susceptible to economic swings than you see in some other sectors out there. And so that helps the stability factor when it comes to different economic cycles, and you largely see these trends that are unmoving. With regard to occupancy, I mean, I have a long-term occupancy trend going back from 2008 to present. Really, it trends within a 200 basis point range during that entire period. I mean, there's just not a lot of volatility in the sector. There's, you know, it's really more of a story of stability rather than volatility.
So my understanding, Mike, is that medical office buildings are a subsector of office in general, and it can be invested in through the typical office platform. Is that true? And how are investors, you know, approaching the sector? Is it just as they would approach office space in general, or are there unique characteristics about medical office? So basically, is it synonymous with office? Are the calculations the same, or are there unique characteristics to the medical office subsector?
It certainly can be underwritten within an office platform. I mean, at the end of the day, there are tenants that are subject to leases, and there's property managers involved, and they look like office buildings in many cases. But there's some very different characteristics about the medical office sector that are not inherent within the general office sector, meaning there's healthcare related services being delivered in these buildings. A lot of times these buildings are either on the hospital campus or on land owned by the hospital, and so the buildings are subject to ground leases that are a different form of underwriting. The types of practices that go in these buildings, you need property managers who really understand the markets and understand these buildings. It's very much like retail in the sense that you want a very synergistic mix of tenancy types. Like, you don't want to have five primary care practices in a all competing in a 20,000 square foot building. You want to have different practices with different types of tenants in these buildings, so there's underwriting characteristics that you have. In addition, they bring in equipment, like you mentioned, MRIs or imaging earlier, that oftentimes has specific space requirements, that have specific build-out requirements, that are very unique to that type of practice and that type of building. So there are a lot of considerations that are very unique to the MOB sector that you don't see in the office sector. And so for that reason, really the most successful investors in the sector have gone through the lengths to set up departments or set up a shop that really specializes in the underwriting of healthcare real estate, to really understand the trends in place, understand the health systems, understand the physicians, and understand different reimbursements and what's driving the physicians' practices and what's driving their businesses. And those outfits or those shops or those departments have really been very successful in this sector because they've been able to go out and really find opportunities that general office investors might not otherwise find.
So obviously there's been a lot of talk about repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's more commonly referred to. Let's say that comes to pass. Any notions as to how it would influence medical office?
To this extent, it's a good question. To this extent, that the ACA, if nothing else, there's all kinds of questions about the viability of it, but it's increased significantly the insurance rolls, which the more insured persons there are in the United States, the more times, theoretically at least, they're going to be visiting the doctor office and physician's clinics and urgent cares and different healthcare practices. So to the extent that there's a straight-out repeal, and I've seen numbers that 20 million or so people could potentially lose insurance. To the extent that happens, you know, that's going to be on, you know, everything else equal, fewer people visiting the doctor than you had the day before they had insurance. So it could affect it in that standpoint. I think the estimates, from what the estimates that I see, is that most physician groups have argued that they haven't seen much bump from the ACA. You know, the hospitals themselves have seen a bump from the ACA, particularly in hospitals. One of their missions is they care for anybody, regardless of their ability to pay, and so most hospitals had a large line item in previous years for charity care or uncompensated care, and those line items have generally gotten smaller, especially in the states where Medicaid has picked up insurance on many of the residents. So, to the extent that there's a repeal, those revenues will largely slow down or go away from on the hospital side, but it's unclear how much that impacts the healthcare practices and physician groups. Most physician groups that you hear about out there have said they've gotten a minimal bump from the ACA, so it stands to reason that they would see minimal decline from any repeal of the ACA.
Well, let's finish up by talking a little bit about performance. I don't know if you have these numbers in front of you, Mike, but what about the NCREIF property index for medical office, as well as NAREIT, what NAREIT has to say about medical office REITs? You said there are some dedicated medical office REITs. What kind of returns are we seeing in the private equity space as measured by NCREIF, and also the publicly traded space as measured by NAREIT? Do you have some statistics you could share with us, or say maybe over the last 3 to 5 years, how medical office has performed?
Yeah, you know, Mike, it's a great question, and I have it on my list to go meet with the folks at NCREIF. I don't know that they break out medical office right now. I don't know if it's broken out from office, and we, you know, through our database, we can certainly help them do that. So I need to go out and reach out to them. I know back when I was with the National Investment Center, we had a big effort to do that on the senior housing side, and I believe there is a separate sort of carve out on senior housing now. So we'd like to do something similar on the medical office side. But when you talk about performance on the REIT side, I mean, the MOB REITs, when you relate those REITs like HTA and HR and Physicians Realty Trust, comparative to all the other healthcare REITs out there, trade at the highest FFO multiples and really have generated the highest returns of most of the healthcare REITs out there, and you know, as a result, their dividend yields are you know, comparative to other healthcare REITs, are generally lower than what you see from the diversified REITs or skilled nursing REITs or other healthcare REITs out there. So they've performed better on the private equity side. We see, you know, one way we can measure is through cap rates. And we've seen over the past several years, we've seen really what we amount to compression across the board with regard to cap rates for medical office buildings. Obviously, the Class A assets in MOB, and this is one way they're different from office, are not, you know, core, you know, suburban or urban, core business district, high-rise buildings built in the last 5 years. They're more, is it on the campus of a credit-rated hospital, in a good market with good demand? Those are generally the Class A assets that you see out there. For those, you know, you'll oftentimes, depending upon the market, whether it's a Boston or a Seattle or some of the really high-end markets for medical office buildings, if it's on the campus or fully occupied or highly occupied by a credit-rated healthcare system like a University of Pennsylvania, you'll see cap rates in the low fives or even high fours for some of those types of assets, depending upon the market. So cap rates can go low, and the returns generated off of that are very stable. They might be akin to what you see in some of the better office markets. There are value add players in the space that can generate, project IRRs in the mid teens to upper teens. But overall, returns are very competitive with what you see in other asset classes, along with the stability that you see from the sector.